ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
Just take a few minutes to delve into the world of science. And I do want to start with a new study from the University of Arizona. And what it's trying to say is that new species are being discovered faster than ever before. You go back over older research and you'd think that the sort of rate of discovery peaked around 1900 and it was slowing down. Scientists may be running out of species. However, these new findings show that there are currently around 16,000 new species discovered per year, with the potential for a lot more. Now, to tell us all about it, once again, very excited, joining us for Nightlife Science, Zoe Keane, ABC Science Communicator. Zoe, welcome to Nightlife.
It's lovely to be here.
How does this accelerated rate of discovery, I guess, reshape what we think about biodiversity?
Yeah, well, it's easy to kind of have this idea that all the, well, taxonomy, so naming and classifying new species, is not easy science, but it's easy to kind of think all of that basic work of going out and seeing what's there is done, and we probably kind of have a good idea, know what's what and what's about. And one of the really exciting things about this research is it's giving us a bit of a wake-up call and saying, hang on, actually, no, we don't. And researchers are figuring out that there are all these new species, finding them at a rate of knots faster than we ever have before. And it's, some of them are, you know, tiny things that we needed the new technology to come on board to tell us that, you know, this, you know, one cell was different to one other cell type thing. But there are even mammals and bigger animals that are being described still to this day, which is really exciting. It's exciting that there's still that element of mystery out there.
This is genuinely exciting, but I also know that too often we're discovering species as they're about to go extinct, which is pretty heartbreaking, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a little bit tragic. And one of my go-to examples of this is a species called the smooth handfish. So this was a fish that was collected when the French, during the time of Napoleon, went on a scientific and colonial mission around Australia. You know, they had their eyes on our territory a little bit, or on this country a little bit. But also there was, it was like the space race, but, you know, back in time, right? And there was this big scientific competition between the French and the English, and they did a lot of surveying and they got a lot of biological samples. And one of the samples they got was this tiny little species in Lutruwita, Tasmania, called the smooth handfish. So we've got a few handfish. Some now are incredibly endangered. And this one, they only got one single fish of it, and it's now living in France. Well, it's dead. You know, it's in the Museum of Zoology in Paris. And we only know that it ever existed because of this one specimen. So if that hadn't been described, we would never know it existed. And there's, to me, that begs the question, how many species, some of which are quite large, have gone extinct without us ever knowing it? When it comes to the species that live here on this continent, they probably were known and understood, but weren't put into the scientific literature. And it's really important for us to know what's around and know what is still here to protect it. So this work describing new species and describing the life that we have on Earth is really important in terms of that extinction question, because there could be species that are going extinct without us even knowing about it. And if we can describe what is out there and if we know what species are living on Earth, then we can work out or how to best protect these species and what these species need in terms of our help, or maybe us not signing up for a particular development in a particular area. So that is incredibly important. And it's important to know that, there is a lot more work to be done. If we had really kind of got the job done and hit our peak of scientific descriptions in the early 1900s and there was just a few, bacteria and odd little cryptic plants that were left to be added, we could maybe not give taxonomy the attention it deserves. It doesn't get the attention it deserves, but this is a reminder to us that we actually need to give these scientists their due and give them support and give them funding. But even without as much funding as I think they deserve, they're doing an amazing job. And in the last 20 years, there's been a massive uptick in species described, which is very cool.
I want to talk about some of the techniques you touched on earlier that are letting us make these discoveries, but we're also seeing, I guess, surprising amounts of biodiversity in areas we wouldn't have expected.
Yeah. I mean, we're finding biodiversity in bizarre places. And one of the really cool things is we're able to go into new places now. So we weren't able to sample, say, the bottom of the ocean back in the day. And we weren't able to look at things on a really tiny scale. So this particular piece of research looked at all life that had been described with this incredible, you know, going through these incredible databases. And it only excluded viruses because it's controversial as to whether they're around. But, yeah, if you think about a scientist in 1910, they're not getting down to the bottom of an ocean trench or anything like that. So we're able to go into more places now.
And, of course, when it comes to, you mentioned before, species that look like each other but might have a cell or two different, cryptic species, you know, they are some amazing discoveries that technology are letting us make.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes you might be talking about something that's very small, like two different species of bacteria, but sometimes you might be talking about something that's quite large. So there might be two beetles that look exactly the same, and if you go and count the hairs on their legs, they seem exactly the same. But then when you test them genetically, or you go and look at other molecular markers around them, they're incredibly different, and maybe they've got this totally different evolutionary history and they're operating in really different ways on the inside. But you know, you just can't judge a book by a cover. You can't judge a plant by its leaves necessarily.
And not to bring it sort of all back to humanity as well, but I mean, when we do make a lot of these discoveries, it does advance things like, oh, I don't know, medicine and beyond just our understanding of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So partly, I find this a tricky thing to talk about. Often with a research paper like this, when you're talking about species extinction or talking about understanding life on Earth, the researchers will talk about why those species might be important to us. And they try and create that connection between how it can benefit ourselves in a very specific way to save these species. And I think that's really important. But I do always want to say, even without that, intrinsically, they're really important, and it's important to know. But these researchers did add in the media that they put out around this recent paper that we do things like discover new drugs and medicines through inspiration from biology. So bioprospecting is a really big field in pharmaceutical research where people will go out and look at a whole range of species. They'll potentially maybe work with indigenous communities in the South America to learn about their indigenous medicine and then learn what active compounds are in a specific plant that could be used to, you know, create a new drug. And the example that they used here were the Gila monsters, which are these incredible lizards that you find, I think they're in North and Central America. They were something that is in their body was an inspiration to GLP-1 receptor agonist drugs. So that's the big Ozempic craze that is happening at the moment, which, you know, has really changed medicine. And so that particular medicine that a whole lot of people who, you know, around Australia are using now for a whole range of different things from, you know, diabetes, you know, a whole range of things. That was taken from a biological inspiration. So it is important to know that these species could do something for us. But even if they couldn't, you know, the Gila monster might have a relation that has absolutely no function to us, but it's important in its own right.
I would think is, to me, just such a big way that scientific understanding changes. Like when I was a kid, the Gila monster was regarded as the only venomous lizard. We know that's not true now. I think that's really cool the way we're continually adjusting on that. Had no idea that it was the forefront of Ozempic. Good on you, Gila monster. Well done.
I know. Well, and now we know that Komodo dragons have some venom in them as well as these bacteria. And so in their mouths, so if a Komodo dragon, you know, bites a water buffalo, we used to think it was just that they had this horrible bacteria in their mouth that slowly killed the water buffalo, but now we know there's a bit of venom in there. So maybe that'll be the next drug that comes along.
Well, at least we can stop slandering Komodo dragons as just having poor dental hygiene.
Look, you would never catch me slandering a Komodo dragon. They're magnificent, magnificent beasts. Really interesting too. You know, they can have babies without finding a mate. So they can find a mate and have babies the usual way. Or if there's no no males around. They can just do it themselves. So they're pretty interesting creatures, the old Komodo dragons.
And apparently quite smart. I remember doing a behind-the-scenes tour at Taronga Zoo in Sydney where they let me know that once the Komodo dragon worked out how to use the bolt on its gate and let itself out.
Oh, no. That's the stuff of nightmares. I'm not surprised. They live in a complicated environment. So if you're, you know, chasing down a water buffalo, you got to have some smarts about you.
We are going to run out of time soon. There's still so much to talk about, Zoe, including consciousness. Now, I did a psychology degree back in the day. I padded it out with philosophy. And in both of those, we talked so much about the consciousness and eventually just kind of hand-waved it as saying, but we'll work all that a little bit later. Do we actually have a new theory on how it works?
Yeah, it's called the hard problem of consciousness. So philosophers, and I'm sure this came across in your studies, that it's the hard problem, and it's hard because you can never know the experience of another person, right? So it's already really tricky. And then you start talking about other species and it just gets even more complicated. But there's a new piece of, I wouldn't say research out, it's more a new piece of a new way of conception, a new theory, a new hypothesis around how consciousness works. And it's out of an Estonian team, so the Estonian Research Council. And essentially they're looking at two different ways consciousness is often talked about. It can be talked about as quite like a computer. So you've got your hardware and you've got your software, and your hardware is the physical bits and then your software is the algorithm that's going on top of it. And if we can work out how our hardware and our software are working together, maybe we can replicate that in terms of AI, that type of thing. And the other way that consciousness is often talked about is that it's an intrinsic part of biology. So it's inseparable from life, essentially, and it's inseparable from the living body. And so biology isn't just a vehicle for cognition, so thinking, but it is part of what cognition is.
Oh.
And these are two camps that it's oil and water, these ideas, right? So one idea is, well, we're kind of just like computers. And the other idea is, no, life is really intrinsic and special and can't be replicated. And so if you're trying to understand consciousness, and in this case, which it makes me a little bit uncomfortable, think about how you could create consciousness artificially, you need to work out, are these ideas correct? And they're saying, well, maybe they're so far apart and we're not getting anywhere in this argument because they need to be synthesized and brought together. So what they have done is created a new idea. So we had computational functionalism and biological naturalism. Those were the two ideas, your computer or your, you know, some wet biology. They've got their new idea, which is biological computationalism. And this is, they say that it's controversial. So this is a new piece of research just out, and it's the Christmas period. So we will see the controversy in the months to come as people reply to their new idea and think about it and respond. But they say that there are three things ways that you could think about the biology and these computational kind of factors coming together. So they say that it might actually be a hybrid thing, which combines this very continuous and very dynamic part of being alive. So, you know, we're not just a digital system of zeros and ones where, you know, have these very complicated soup of biology and electricity and, you know, different chemicals in our brain working all at the same time. And then the physical structure of our brain is all coming together. So it's very multifactorial. So they say it's a hybrid of these kind of discrete events and then continuous events, that continuous biological events. And they also make the point that, well, we're what they call metabolically grounded, but we know this is, we've got a limited energy store. We need to eat and we need to fuel our body. So we're working in a very kind of constrained way, and that the way our biology has, you know, created consciousness is in this environment of energy optimization. So they're bringing together these two ideas in a way that's really interesting, but they also have suggestions as to kind of how to create artificial intelligence, bringing these two things together. What they say is they're not saying that you need to have biology, you need to be alive to have consciousness, but they do say that the way that AI, you know, these generative AI systems are coming up with ideas, it might seem like consciousness sometimes, but it's not. And the way that you could move it towards a more conscious system is to have biologically inspired technology. So I really don't know how I feel about this. It's an interesting contribution in terms of the way they're thinking about the way we think. But then the application is, AI is going very fast.
And yeah.
It's a world out there.
We live in a world where all roads lead to AI eventually at the moment. For how much longer, we don't know. I keep hearing that 2026 will be when that bubble bursts, but we're just going to have to wait and see where that goes. Hey, we've nearly run out of time. Tell me about the book you've edited. Tell me about the best Australian science writing of 2025.
It's a good summer read for you all. If these kind of conversations get your mind started, this is a collection of the best writing from, it's from 2024, comes out in 2025.
Yeah.
And it's a collection of these incredible Australian writers. I worked with Tegan Taylor, who people might know from the Coronacast back in the day, as she's on Life Matters on Radio National, now an incredible science journalist in her own right. We worked together to sift through hundreds and hundreds of pieces of Australian science writing and selected the very best ones and put them all together in a book. So there's incredible biology, physics, chemistry stories. It's a great read. My absolute favourite piece, and I'm allowed to say it's my favourite because we gave it an award at the end, so it's officially our favourite piece, was this really beautiful story about the acknowledgement sections in PhDs. So PhDs, if you've ever known someone who has written a PhD or seen someone on the TV who's written a PhD, it's often impossible to understand. The only person who really knows it, what it means, is the person who marked it and the person who wrote it and maybe the supervisor. They're very dense, but the acknowledgements are very heartfelt. And this piece beautifully pairs these dense and complicated titles with these very human and heartfelt acknowledgements. And it's from PhDs over the decades. And it really shows the human story of science when, people are often, scientists themselves are often isolated from their peers when they're so deep in their research, right? Because nobody else gets it. And this is a way to show the person behind the science. And, it brought me to tears, and I know that it's brought a few readers to tears. So I really recommend the book for that piece alone. But if there's a piece about consciousness here too, insect consciousness. So, I recommend it. I did edit it, but so I'm biased, but I would say it's a good summer read.
Zoe, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it, and thanks for having time for Nightlife.
Great to chat.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.